Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the three ring circus that is the fiscal cliff. We're still alive. We're not fighting seagulls for hot dog buns, so we must be okay. Can political civility exist in Washington, D.C., in the new 113th Congress, or even at all in any part of politics? This and a look back on what important is going to happen in the upcoming year, and my favorite part, tell me a story, today on Backroom Politics. And good afternoon, everybody, and Happy New Year to everybody out there in Radio Land. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 Hudson Street, New York, our nation's capital, Washington. Joining me as they do every Tuesday for the first time in 2013, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the newly rehabilitated new version of Al 2.0, Congressman Al Swift. How you doing, Congressman? As he chokes. Great. Good way to kick off 2013.
What I wanted to say was I'm feeling much better.
I hope so.
Obviously, it was going to be a lie.
Yeah, well, first of all, you joined us, and that was amazing. You had a little bit of a spell over the New Year's break, but the Iron Man that you are, you came and joined us to kick off 2013.
Absolutely. I wouldn't miss the first show of the year for anything.
Fantastic. To my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for then Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He's the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Jeff. And I also had a New Year's break.
Yeah, you broke your ankle.
Yes.
You know, this is the problem when you run a political radio show with four old white guys. Alan, I'll get to you next because I know you're on the line. But we'll get to that. Are you feeling better, I hope?
Absolutely.
Very good. Very good. To my right, the only member of the old man clan that is not sick. He is the former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland, longtime Washington insider, Carl Tooven. Happy New Year, Carl.
Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to all of you out in radio land.
Fantastic. And on the air, joining us remotely from a decontamination tent somewhere in the Virginia area, he is the longtime Senate staffer, former Undersecretary of Commerce, who served under last count four presidents. He is a very distinguished but apparently sickly fellow at the Simpson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hi, Alan. How you doing?
Gentlemen, believe me, I'm doing you a favor by not being in your presence.
I know, because we have a mute button when you start talking those facts.
Yeah.
Don't laugh too hard. It'll make you cough.
But Happy New Year.
Exactly. I'm your moderator, Radio Justin Russell, and we have got a lot to talk about. I'm putting you on mute until we get to you.
I won't be coughing. I'll. But anyway, whatever you like.
Okay, hold on, Alan. We have a lot to get to. There is so much. This is our first show of 2013. Since we left before Christmas, lots of things have happened. We managed to avoid the fiscal cliff, unbeknownst to anybody. We managed to kick the can down the road for another 60 to 90 days. We managed to seat a brand new Congress. The new 113th Congress is alive and kicking on Capitol Hill. We're seeing transitions in the administration, those coming, those going. Lots of news there. Political civility, political alliances we never thought we'd even imagine in a long time, most notably that between Vice President Joe Biden and Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. Amazing stuff going on. But let's start with the big, big topic is the fiscal cliff. Before we left, everybody was counting down the days before the fiscal cliff threw us into turmoil. We were going to get downgraded by just about every credit agency. We were going to be paying loan sharks to get our bills paid. It was going to be horrendous. However, we managed to find a quote-unquote deal to let us continue on down the road. Let me start off, Congressman Al. The fiscal cliff deal that came down the pike, I mean, first of all, not a huge glowing endorsement of political civility at all. Did you see any shining lights in anything that happened in the last couple of weeks of December leading into January?
No, I didn't. Those who I think were capable of civil debate and civil compromise for various reasons had one foot nailed to the floor, so they couldn't get to that place. And the rest seemed to enjoy throwing rocks at each other. And I don't think we dealt with the fiscal cliff. I think we, you know, I hate the phrase kick the can down the road because it's been used so often, but we did it again.
Bob Hines, what were you seeing as we were going down the fiscal cliff path leading up to the end of the year, leading up to the deadline on January 31st?
Well, like most people who have a brain in their head, I was hoping that we would get a more full and complete solution. We did not. We didn't solve the fiscal cliff, if there was one. What we did, we stumbled over the threshold, and we were able to reach an agreement which was very limited. It's a good agreement in the sense that it raises some revenues. That's good. It also made some taxes permanent. The Bush tax cuts permanent. I'm not sure that's good, bad, or indifferent. But I think it would be. It's probably good now while the economy needs some boost. It may not be good in 3 or 4 years from now when we are pushing right along. We don't need tax cuts. But the reality is we have at least gotten past the disaster of everything screwed up because nothing got done. And I think that in the next 60 days, I hope that in the next 60 days, some of the activists on both sides of the aisle, the very liberal, the very conservative folks, who are all, you know, my way or the highway on both sides, I would hope they would see how dangerous it is to not get a full solution, and I hope we will be able to do something. I don't have high hopes.
Let me go to Alan Moore. Alan Moore, what surprised you about the fiscal cliff? Was there anything stunning about, well, not that political discourse is stunning, but was there anything that really caught your eye going up to the December 31st deadline?
Well, there were several things that caught my eye. I wasn't expecting this particular outcome, that they would just do, if you will, part of the revenue piece. Remember, there was a revenue piece, taxes scheduled to rise on January 1, and this so-called sequester, the spending piece, where across the board, spending cuts were going to be invoked. It's the spending piece that got kicked down the road, although I don't think we're by any means done on the revenue side. What was done on the revenue side was pretty big stuff. The Republicans conceded to increase rates. The president gave a little bit on the people, the income level on which rates would be increased. He wanted everybody above $250,000 a year. It's $400,000 a year. The president made major concessions, though, on estate and gift taxes. So the very same people who are going to be paying the higher income taxes caught, I think, a significant break on the estate and gift piece. And that surprised me a little, not a lot. In 2 months, we've got another, the sequester will be scheduled to come back, and we'll have to make decisions between now and then, or we'll get up to the point and kick the can down the road again. We'll see. The point is that a deal did get cut by a most unlikely combination of guys, the vice president, who's subject to ridicule, Mitch McConnell, who takes a lot of grief. They're the two guys who put it together. That was probably the biggest surprise of all.
Carl Tubin, I want to ask you a question. What surprised you about the wranglings of going into December 31st and the fiscal cliff negotiations?
I think what surprised me the most was the call that McConnell made to the vice president and asked him to get involved and keep him moving, which he did. And we all know that the vice president acting for the president in this whole thing, so everyone was involved except for the fact that it was the big work was done between Joe Biden and
Jerry Reid, minority leader Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, rather. I'm sorry.
And I think you're going to see more of that as we go down the road. The other thing that kind of bothered me is that we really didn't get to cuts. And the fact that we've got this debt ceiling coming up 15 days earlier than expected means that we're going to have a lot, there's going to be a lot on the plates of those people who are negotiating. I hope that all this coming together at once doesn't make us stumble.
Well, let's look at some of the big highlights of what was actually in the deal that came down in a 2 a.m. vote on New Year's Day, and then a last by the House. One of the big ticket items that everybody noticed was the tax increase. Where's the tax rates going to cut down? Well, the tax cut down is going to be basically at $400,000 for a single income house, $450,000 for joint filers of income taxes. That is substantially higher than what the Obama administration was pushing for $250,000, but substantially lower than the Republicans at $1 million. Al, was this a good compromise in your eyes?
Well,
yes.
Let me say that first of all. No compromise that doesn't give you everything you want can you consider a good compromise, I guess. But this seems to be a balanced compromise between the two points of view. I don't know why it took them so long to get there. It's a fairly obvious solution of dividing things down the middle, and I think it ought to work. The other thing that I think, when we get to spending, I just do not see how Congress is going to take on spending, particularly entitlement programs, in this same way. I think you're going to have a special committee that will sit down on a very, very bipartisan basis and go through those things one at a time. Now, perhaps the House Tax Writing Committee may do that. The chairman has already started doing some work, and if it can be done within the confines of the committee structure of the House, I would be delighted. But that's where you're going to really find knuckle beating kinds of problems. And so if we've taken care of the financial part of it for a while, we better get over to the spending side and set that up in a way that that Nancy Pelosi can't just throw a monkey wrench into cogs, and for that matter, no Republicans can do the same thing.
Well, Alan Moore, when you look at it though, it seems like that was a pretty bitter pill to swallow with several Republicans, including notably Marco Rubio of Florida, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Charles Grassley out of Iowa. I mean, these are some pretty staunch Tea Party Republicans in the Senate. Why was this such a bitter pill to swallow?
Well, nobody liked putting this kind of a deal together this particular way, and the fact that you've got a number of Republicans who say no, we don't like the mix, it's wrong, and you got a few Democrats saying, no, we don't like the mix, it's wrong. That's actually what you want. You want some people on both sides to say no. So I was surprised that there were as few negative votes in the Senate as there were on the package. I think what was significant, though, is the vote in the House, because for the first time, Speaker Boehner was forced into a position where he had to allow a bill to pass the House that did not enjoy a support of the majority of the Republican majority. That is something he has refused to do, that he hates to do, that he can't afford to do more than a couple of times, because it really brings into question what it means to be in control of the House. But in this case, he had gotten boxed in. He could not get the votes for a proposal, the so-called Plan B, that he could not bring to a vote because he didn't have the votes. He was a few short. What that meant was he got pushed aside. We had Biden and McConnell negotiating the deal. He agreed to bring it to the House. He encouraged some of his people to vote for it, or certainly allowed them to. He wanted it to pass because we needed to solve the so-called cliff problem. But it was from the Republican standpoint in the House a show of weakness, limited strength, and a reminder of how difficult his task is within his caucus.
Congressman Al, you had a comment.
Well, I can see why many Republicans felt that it was an incomplete decision, because they really didn't address spending cuts. Now, around this table, Republicans and Democrats alike have agreed there are going to have to be some revenue increases, and that has been done. There may have to be more, for all we know, and spending cuts. Those were not addressed. So even the Democrats sitting around this table agree that that has to be done. The thing that it seems to me is if you try to take it on as spending cuts, huge, huge mouthfuls of stuff, it will be impossible, excuse me, to chew. But if you take on, for example, can you extend the date during which people must pay Social Security? Can you reduce the amount you have to you get in Social Security and kind of means test it in a fashion so that people that are making $500,000 a year at age 70 aren't getting their little $3,000 worth of Social Security, which can go back. I think you're going to have to approach the spending cuts in that kind of a one-by-one fashion, so you can work out something that is fair each individually.
Bob Hines.
I agree with Al in the way they have to approach it. The Republicans have already given significantly $640 billion in taxes over the next decade.
Yep.
Revenue. There will probably be more. I think the president's saying that he will refuse to negotiate on the entitlements is just ridiculous. The Ways and Means Committee, under the direction of Mr. Camp, has done a good job in a preliminary way of identifying a lot of tax code expenditures that are really out of date and don't need to be extended. Things like ethanol, getting the ethanol people getting a $4 billion benefit every year. There's a whole bunch of things we don't need to do anymore.
But wait, let me just jump in on this, though, Bob. I mean, in this same bill that everybody seemed to have compromised on, one of the big sticking points was the so-called dairy cliff was included in this, which included a whole bunch of farmland subsidies. Does that make sense?
There's a whole lot of other stuff they stuck in.
Oh, yeah, we haven't even touched on some of the minutiae stuff, but the dairy cliff is a big pill.
Well, I can tell you that at least half of the bill is all this extra stuff. But the point is, what has to be done is, in the future, we're going to have to do two things. And I think maybe Al is right. Maybe we're going to have to send it back to the existing committees. Maybe the folks who deal with, the subcommittee that deals with Medicare and Medicaid has got to try to find a way to save some money in the program. The people who deal with Social Security, we're at the subcommittee who deals with that and the Ways and Means is going to have to look at that. I think Al's got some reasonably good ideas. Those kinds of things, little by little, you don't need to, if you move carefully, you don't need to have to cut off anybody's hand, you know, with respect to benefits. All you got to do is, you know, cut off one joint of your little finger. Just to give you an example of what some of the numbers are, the average couple retiring in 2012, last year, is under normal circumstances of their life, will probably get about $966,000 of benefits over their lifetime. They will have paid in about, the number is $722,000. So they're getting $250,000 in benefits more than they paid in. Now that's just every couple. Now multiply that by all the couples that are in, multiply that by the huge incoming boomers who are going to be hitting. They're a huge number. They're much, much larger than the millennials behind them by maybe a factor of 50, maybe 30%. And so when we get to that age bracket and Medicare is kicking in for them and Social Security is kicking in for them, there is no possible way that we can pay our bills. We have spent, talking about the federal government expenditures, about $3.2 trillion in expenditures. What we spent on Social Security and Medicare last year was $1.2 trillion. So they're taking over a third of the federal budget right now.
But
we're going to be at 40% by the end of the decade.
But let me go to Alan Moore. But Alan, when you talk means testing, I mean, that sparks a different reaction depending on which side of the aisle you talk to. But what surprised me was that it was that you'd think that the Democrats would be against means. It was the Republicans coming out against means testing. Does that make sense?
Well, part of our problem here is what you mean by means testing. These programs, the two big ones that are so much in the spotlight now with the baby booming generation retiring, Social Security and Medicare, are already major redistributors of wealth in this country. The less you pay in, the more you take out, whether it's Medicare or Social Security. Having said that, neither one is sustainable over the long term. Is it means testing? If you get a higher rate of return, the less you pay in? I don't know that that means testing, because means testing historically has meant whether you get a benefit or not. And what we've got is a program is two different programs where you take benefits out irrespective of how much you put in, but the more you put in effect, the lower your rate of return. So the term means testing just doesn't work for me. Now, there are those who think that the upper-income folks, even though they get a really lousy rate of return on their income, shouldn't get anything. Well, then it would truly be a means test. You don't need it, you don't get it.
Alan, but when you look at some of the proponents, some of the notable proponents of means testing, Bill Gates, Jack Welch, Warren Buffett, some of the richest people in America are saying, look, I don't need this. Means testing should be very simple. What makes it so complex in the eyes of Congress?
Well, it's fine for the billionaires. They don't need anything, for God's sakes. But how about the person who's in retirement, is put together between pension and savings and IRAs and KIOs and everything else, $150,000 of income? They're pretty well off. Should they get Medicare? You bet their bottom dollar they need to get Medicare, because they're not going to get health insurance anywhere else, and their livelihood is put at risk. So in any one of these, don't talk to me about Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, because they're the outliers. They don't need any of this. It's the It's the millions of people that are at the margins of wealth, let's say. They already get a rotten return on their investment, and that's just the way the programs are structured. How bad does that deal need to be? How bad can it be? That's where you get into the problem. It's the devil is always in the details when you're trying to define this stuff.
Well, Carl, too, in the fiscal cliff talks, when we were talking about means testing, we had a lot of Democrats supporting the idea. What makes means testing, as they were talking on the Hill, attractive to Democrats?
Now, let me just say one thing about Republicans. You know, they come up with an idea, means testing, and some other ideas. Now, all of a sudden, the Democrats say, that's a good idea, we ought to do it. And what happens? Republicans say no. So that's number one. I think that, you know, I think the Democrats believe that there are certain people who make a lot of this money that can afford to have it means tested, especially Social Security. Now, I don't agree with Medicare that should be means tested. I mean, Medicare is something that people need for the reasons that Alan gave. But I think as far as people who are very, very wealthy, it should be a means test to see whether they can get it. That would help the system. The other thing that would help the system, and I go back to Mayor Bloomberg, who says, reform immigration, and let's get people in who are going to work, going to have Social Security numbers, who are going to pay into the system, and if we get enough of them, then we would not have some of the bigger problems that we have today. It would be moderated to.
Congressman Al.
And Carl puts in relief something that I should have said earlier with regard to means testing. I don't think we can take every single program and say, well, means testing is the solution to it. And the difference between Social Security and Medicare is beautiful. I can see lots of ways you can means test Social Security, money going in or when it comes out or both. And you'll have a big wrestling match over that, because the Republicans will probably want to be tighter on that than the Democrats do, and so they'll fight about it. But I think it can be done there. It gets a lot more complicated when you start talking about Medicare, and there I think you've got to start talking about how we deliver medical care in this country, and can it be done efficiently and less expensively, and those kinds of things, which are going to be a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated and a lot more.
Bob Hines and Carl Tooven.
Well, the reality is we're talking about it here in a very sensible way. We know what the problems are. We understand how they got to get solved. So do the folks on Capitol Hill. The problem with them is nobody wants to move off their own dime. And I don't know how we're going to get that done, but if we don't get it done, and relatively quickly, we are going to be in a much more serious position than we are today, because every day, 10,000 more people become eligible for Social Security and Medicare. We've got to do something. I know I'm sound like a broken record, but my God, we've got to find a way for some people to just be responsible up on Capitol Hill and start to do some hard work and do it on a bipartisan basis. And probably the best place to do it in is not special committees. It's in the committees that exist right now and know what the problems are better than anybody else and are willing to take the risk of doing it.
Well, hold that thought, because we're going to talk about that in an upcoming segment. But, Carl Tune, I'm going to give you the last word.
I forgot what I was going to say, so I can't.
All right, well, then Bob Hines has the last word. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the fiscal cliff, and we're going to talk about where do we go from here when it comes to solving the fiscal crisis in this country. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom,
They think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Back Room, Shelley's Back Room has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me. Breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue our discussion right now about the fiscal cliff. We talked a little bit about the events and some of the topics leading up to the December 31st, New Year's Day, January 2nd deal making. What we got to talk now about is, all right, we kicked the can down the road a little bit. We managed to stave off somewhat of a disaster. Where do we go from here? Bob, I want to start off with you. We've talked about spending, yet when we look at the fiscal cliff deal that was passed back on January 2nd by the House, it actually increased spending by upwards of about $640 million. How does that make sense when we know the one thing that's basically out of control is deficit spending in the federal government?
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense on the long term, but it may be that you're going to have to spend a little bit now to grease some of the wheels we're going to have to spend. But reality is that we don't have a lot of time and to get things done, because we have until the end of March to resolve the fiscal cliff problem.
Right.
Which means we have got to get a long-term solution for the deficit problems, number one. Number two, the debt ceiling, sometime in late February, about 30 days before fiscal cliff problem comes to a head, the deficit comes to a head. We run out of the ability to borrow money. We've already got $16.4 trillion in debt. And we can't pay our bills. We haven't paid our bills. And it's just like a credit card. It's like a family with a credit card. We have just been spending money and we have not paid our bills. Now, we have both of those problems coming up. The president has said, very, very bluntly, I will not permit any discussion of anything except a clean deficit fix bill. Fact of the matter is, the Republicans, who have in effect said, here's $640 billion in taxes over the next decade, has said, we are going to ask for some cuts. And we're going to ask for some of those cuts when we're talking about the debt ceiling. Now, I'm sure the Democrats will say that, well, you're being reckless with the economy, and you're being reckless with our financial security, and you're being reckless with our international payments. And I think that there's a legitimate argument made for that. I also think there's a legitimate argument to be made for the fact that that's what the Democrats say every time you talk about any change in the entitlement programs.
Congressman, now you look like you're about to spew out something important.
Well, I don't know how important it is. It seems to me that going about cuts, spending cuts with a meat cleaver is what Republicans tend to do, and which the Democrats will always resist. It needs to be more scalpel-like. Now, for example, we mentioned earlier that we just tacked a great dairy thing onto the
fiscal cliff bill.
Let me tell you. The dairymen in this country are the toughest, I think, in the entire agricultural field to deal with. I had the three largest dairy counties in the state in my district, and I got to tell you, these are tough people. Now, mine weren't the great, big, huge industrial dairy farms. They were much. They were. Are you okay?
No. Just making signs to the people outside. We're good. Keep going.
I think he was swearing.
I was. No. Just getting people's attention. They're going to lose what you're going to say. Keep going. It's good. You're on a roll.
The point that I was trying to make is, going to have trouble with farm people. Or subsidy. The Midwest doesn't vote anyway. You know. And dairymen are very, very powerful, even small ones. And the fact is, cuts in the dairy supports are going to reduce small dairymen. They're gone. So that's going to be a step that is going to industrialize, if you will, our farming industry and our dairy industry.
Yeah, but Alan Moore, that's been something. I mean, when you talk about agriculture subsidies, I mean, that's been an argument that the Democrats have put out there for a long time, that if you take away agricultural subsidies, whether it's to the dairymen, whether it's to the ranchers, whether it's to the grain growers, it's going to turn the agriculture community from mom and pop and family farms into a large industrial complex, yet we see the industrial complexes go away. You go out to places like Boone, Iowa, and you don't see family farms anymore. They're all corporate owned. So have we crossed that bridge and this is a moot point?
Well, in the real world, we've long since crossed that bridge. However, in the political world, we still hear about protecting the family farms, of whom there are still a handful here and there, enough to make the argument credible, but it doesn't reflect the reality. I wanted to respond to something Al was talking about earlier, because he was talking about how Republicans tend to like the Meat Axe approach to cuts, and he is urging the use of a scalpel. Well, I don't see anybody on either side being willing to do much of anything. There's Tea Party folks who don't really understand everything that the government does, who are perfectly willing to blow everything up. But beyond that, you don't see a lot of people talking very specifically about cutting, whether it's the entitlements that we were talking about before a little bit, the Social Security and Medicare, for which there's not a great deal of appetite, and then all these other things that we spend money on, whether it's ag programs, including dairy, or anything else, whether it's a scalpel or a meat axe, I wish somebody was on one side or the other, and particularly in the White House, was serious about long-term spending reform. We've got this problem we've talked about over and over again. The current recovery is very, very fragile. This is not the time for big, giant spending cuts. But what we need to do is get on a path where over the next 10 years we can see trend lines of spending decline and hope that we'll have enough recovery that we'll be able to grow ourselves partly out of our problem, increase revenues partly to solve the problem, and lower the spending path. The sad part so far in all the fiscal cliff stuff is we took a look at part of it, part of the revenue stuff, and we've kicked everything else down the road.
But Bob Hines, you know, when we talk about big spending cuts, you know, whether Republicans use a scalpel or a meat cleaver, you know, the one organization that everybody looks to as far as, and to the best of my knowledge, never serving in Congress, but Congress still needs the quote-unquote green light from the CBO to go ahead with any fiscal packages, such as what we saw in the fiscal cliff deal. When the CBO says, hey, look, we're going to be increasing spending, even though it's supposed to be a tax and spending cut deal, but we're still going to green light it, does CBO have responsibility in this to at least show the reality, or are they living in a dream world?
The CBS's responsibility,
CBO.
CBO's responsibility is to look at the legislation, look at what the law says, and evaluate what that means going forward.
But they still have to put real numbers in front of the members.
They've got to put real numbers in front, but it's up to the members. By God, that's the problem. The members are the problem, all of them.
Congressman Al.
I agree, and as surprising as it may be, I agree with about 95% of what Alan said in his previous comments. And I didn't get to...
That is surprising.
Well, I didn't get a chance to finish what I was saying. And let me see if I can say it very briefly. What I was saying was you're going to be running into special interest groups, the agriculture community being one of the strongest and most difficult. But there will be others as well. And while a member of Congress will vote against a big corporate something or other, it hates that members hate to vote against a whole bunch of little people in that. I could have taken on two or three big corporate farms in my district. Taking on 300 or 400 small farms is a very different matter. In rural communities where the hardware store and the grocery store and everything else depends on it. So I think that, and this is the point I was getting at, it's going to take some guts on the part of Congress to do what needs to be done in making some of these cuts.
We're going to talk about that in the next segment, about who's got guts and who's actually showing leadership and political stability. Bob Hines, you had a comment, though.
Yeah, I know about as much about agricultural policy as I do about the dark side of the moon. Therefore, I'm going to weigh in on something.
That's what we do on this show.
Absolutely.
Alan's the only one with any real facts. Hell.
Well, why don't we tune him in?
We do. He's coughing at his...
Somebody's got to make it
down. Coughing
right?
At the infirmary.
But think about it. I don't know, and Al, maybe you would. But let's talk about, you know, milk producers or any product, catfish or anything else. There are real big players in those worlds, and there are much smaller players. Why isn't it possible to write a bill within the agriculture universe that deals with two of them in a different fashion based upon the size of whatever makes sense?
Well, you're talking about means testing.
Yes, I am.
Special interests.
Well, so what? They need to be means tested. A great big farm.
See, I'm starting to think, Bob, that you actually took the fall and bumped your head, not Al.
No,
you're living in a dream world.
No, what I'm trying to say is one of the solutions we're going to have to deal with is it isn't just cutting Social Security or Medicare. There's a whole lot of things that have to be adjusted. And one of them is farm programming. I know it has to be that because there's so many different programs, there's so many different products, so many different crops, so many different, cotton and wool and everything else. I don't see why we can't find a way, complex as it would be, to set up programs for each of those industries within the agriculture world and deal with them on a basis of different benefits for different sized programs and units of ownership, where the real big guys have all advantages they need. Smaller guys, the ones I think we need to protect, need a little bit more. It seems to me there's a way to do that. I'm not smart enough to understand it, but I got to believe you don't have to
treat, there is a way. You don't
have to treat a huge, huge Texas ranch the same way you do a cattle guy raising 50 head of cattle.
Alan Moore is a fellow Republican to Bob. Can you tell him that he's living in a dream world?
No, I'll tell him that he is absolutely right, that he knows nothing about ag policy.
Hey, I admitted that going in, baby.
I know. So I'm sitting there listening to you expound these ideas that people in the ag world, as Al could tell you, have been wrestling with for decades, making some slow progress, you know, making a couple of steps forward, losing a step back. There are caps on the amount of benefits you can get, but they still need to be further modified. It's big stuff, but it's not the huge stuff that that we're wrestling with at this point in this whole physical cliff business. I mean, what these guys have set themselves up for now, you know, we went through the speed bump, and now we're still got the cliff sitting out there a couple of months out, and the big guys, whoever they are now, and there seems to be a little bit of a shift in who has the power to make decisions and where the votes would come from and all of that, is they're going to have to give instructions to the committees. There's no surprise about this. The President, Boehner, McConnell, Pelosi, and Reid are not going to sit down and say, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to extend the retirement age for 6 months or a year for the purposes of Medicare benefits or the Social Security. They're not going to make those decisions, not sitting around the table. What they will do is they'll say, we can agree that we will find $1 trillion or $2 trillion. Some of it will come from these kinds of programs. Some will come from those kinds of programs. And it's either going to come in a particular way, another across-the-board thing, or the preferable way is the committees of the Congress will come together, figure out how to do that, and we'll have an up or down vote. And they'll set a timetable on it. That's what everybody's always expected. That's what we need. It respects the committees. It doesn't pretend that they are meaningless and that some small group of guys can just come together and say, yeah, here's the answer. Even Simpson Bowles Simpson, which we all like to invoke, they weren't that specific. They just were talked about the general broad categories where the money is wrong and some particular ideas for how you could save money and said, pick one and go do it.
Congressman Al.
And when we get down to the specifics, I have to, in all honesty, suggest that the last place we should try to begin is with agriculture. Farmers are a mean lot worldwide. You know, the farmers in France, the farmers in Europe, the farmers in Asia rise up and object. So that may not be the place to start. You may need to start elsewhere and then say, now everybody else is given the farmers.
Let me jump in, though, because the reality is, when you look at whether it's ag, you know, when you talk about ag and you talk about the ag special interests, it's not the mom and pop dairy farmers that are getting the voice. It's the ADM, the Archer Daniel Midland. It's the ConAgras.
Absolutely.
It's that crew that are driving the policy. But you have – look, when you say special interests in this town, you can replace special interests with industry trade associations. Same thing. The reality is if you go and you say, well, look, it's the smaller family farms that need a voice, all they're going to do is get together and create their own special interests, the Association of Family Farmers. And then you're going to have the people who have New England – who don't believe, and you're going to have 18 different special interest groups all fighting to their own members of Congress. Saying, so ultimately what happens is they cancel each other out, and Archer Daniels, Midland, ConAgra, the rest of those guys are still the ones running the show.
You've already got that.
Thank you, Al.
The dairy industry does not agree with itself. The Midwest fights with New England, and they both fight with the West Coast, and they all have different needs. And coming up with a dairy bill is already an incredibly complex thing because, essentially, the small dairy farmers don't agree on what is good for them. And the big guys are going to come out okay no matter what.
By mind.
Gentlemen, when I raised the issue of agriculture industry, I was not suggesting that that's something that ought to be done right now.
But take any industry, though, Bob.
But the point is, there's a whole lot of things that have to be done. Now, I think the first things that have to be done are dealing with the biggest program to spend the most money, which means we're talking about...
defense?
We're talking about Social Security spends... $200 billion more in defense.
But that's the only
Medicare,
industry. That's
Medicare
the only special
spend
interest.
More than defense.
Yeah, but when you talk about Social Security and Medicare, they're the only special interest that has one unified voice. That's AARP over on E Street.
Shoot
them. To our friends at AARP, we don't mean that. We love you all.
But the fact
Jeff,
is,
we love you, baby.
But the fact of the matter is, that's where you have to start. You've got over $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion going to those two programs this year. Not 10 years from now, not 5 years from now, now. That's over a third of our total government spending. We have to start where the biggest pot of money is because
it's the money
that we need.
But our federal government made that non-discretionary. We don't have a choice that we make part, that we means test, not.
What I am suggesting is that the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee do their work.
Carl Toobin.
Well, there's another thing that we could save money at if the government really got serious about it, and that is fraud in Medicare and Medicaid.
Absolutely.
On the personal side, on the doctor side, we talk about fraud, and it's still there. Nobody really... jumps in to do anything about it.
But Alan Moore, you've been around Senate committees when they talked about Medicare and Medicaid, and fraud has been a key discussion point for decades, yet it seems to be a third rail that nobody really wants to talk about.
No. It's not true at all. People talk about it. We spend tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars trying to root out fraud. On the other hand, there is so much money in those programs, when you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars and rules that are changing and tens of thousands of providers and millions of recipients, everybody, there's all these incentives to try to work the system. It's really hard to figure out how to deal with questions of fraud, A, and B, in the case of Medicare, we've got a system where it's not fraudulent to order up extra tests for somebody. It's not necessarily fraudulent. You can say, he was potentially sick. I wanted him to have these extra tests. It's that reimbursement for tests, not for results, that feeds the inflation in the system that exceeds inflation in the economy. But to say we're not paying attention to fraud is just not true. It's not fair to the people who at CMS who run the program, and it just is not a reflection of reality. It's just very, very hard to do. And every time you close one person down, a couple more pop up.
Then Alan, maybe this is a chicken and egg question, but if we know and we talk about fraud, and we know it's prevalent, and it's a big part of the fiscal spending problem that we deal with in the non-discretionary spending side of the budget, why can't we as a Congress or as a government come up with sustainable, enforceable fraud, anti-fraud policy?
I am no expert on all of the literally thousands of ways that people cheat the system. And I'm not going to say, well, we can do this or that. This is not easy stuff. This is complicated, expensive, time-consuming stuff, and God knows we spend a lot, and God knows we get a lot back. But I think we fool ourselves if we think that simply rooting out fraud and abuse and waste. Don't forget waste. Is going to somehow solve the Medicare problem. It's not. It's the underlying structure of the system and the changing demographics and the inflation in healthcare writ large and the expectations of all Americans that we should be able to get our health paid for and somebody else should pay.
Carl Tooven.
The other thing that amazed me about this bill is $150 million that was given to Hollywood. Now, if they can give $150 million to Hollywood because some companies aren't making enough money, why don't they give $150 million to lobbyists who don't make over a certain amount of income?
I'll take that.
Good idea.
That's a grand idea. I'll be all over that. Thank God. That's the smartest thing you've said all month, Carl.
I know how the $150 million got in there, but it just boggled my mind. And luckily, I haven't read the whole bill to see what else is in there. But in a bill that's supposed to be putting a cap on spending and then to do something like that, And some of the
other everybody knows that the White House is a wholly owned subsidiary of 20th Century Fox. My God, come on. Hey.
The days of Ronald Reagan.
Was he Fox? Yeah, I guess he was a Fox contract actor.
No, but
actually
not since
the days of
Lou Wasserman.
Yes. True. You got that? True. Hey, we're coming up on the break. By the way, it's happy hour here at Backroom Politics. We're going to order our drinks, our cigars, and we're going to go into the second half. When we come back, we're going to talk about the political discourse and the still toxic environment that is Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Time. Let's try it one more once.
Here live at Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. This is our first show of 2013, and after a really lively discussion about the fiscal cliff and the three-ring circus that was, we thought we'd continue on with some of the political wrangling, some of the three-ring circus that is politics here in Washington, D.C., and why D.C. is so toxic. Now, we bring this up because one of the surprises in this deal was, number one, on the House side, how it seems that Speaker Boehner was almost hogtied by utilizing the old rule of, if I can't get the caucus to put it to the floor for a vote, I won't put it on the floor. That's a policy he inherited from former Republican Speaker Dennis Hastert out of Illinois. But it also seems that the big surprise was the big saviors of the day were Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, going to his old friend, Vice President Joe Biden, to get this deal done. I'm going to go to Alan. You spent a lot of years. You worked with both men. Does that surprise you that seems to be the triumvirate that came out of this?
You know, it did surprise me, as I said at the top of the show, because I didn't really expect that Boehner and Reid would, in effect, create this vacuum. Now, the Reid part doesn't surprises me altogether. We know there's problems inside his caucus and with his whole effort on the so-called Plan B, where he couldn't hold the votes together to give himself a little bargaining position. And you've certainly heard me talk before about the disaster that Harry Reid has become, and he continues to remind us that is an ongoing process. Having said that, McConnell's is a clever old guy, and he has been around, and he and Biden have known each other, worked in the Senate. Not ever on the same committee, but certainly as colleagues, and they were two willing parties to fill the vacuum, and were able to put an interesting deal together. Not a great deal, but considering the alternative of nothing, a fabulous deal, where both sides could point to things about it that they like a lot, and also have to squirm some about what was in it. So what surprised me was that Reid was not present, because what happened here was the House having failed at basically Boehner having embarrassed himself a bit by getting out on a limb, came back and said, well, we'll wait on the Senate. Anything the Senate passes, we will bring to the House floor. And that's what he said, and that's what he was locked in and committed to do. And but it was interesting that it wasn't Reid and McConnell putting a deal together, or Reid, McConnell, and Biden, or Jack Lew, or somebody on the president's behalf. What's surprising is it was McConnell and Biden. Huh? Where the hell was Reid? And it speaks again to how much he has hurt himself, I think, with some of his erratic behavior over the last year.
Bob Hines, was the deal or the negotiation between Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden, is that a testament to the old school way of doing things, that it's hard to really throw somebody you've worked with for, in this case, over 30 years, under the bus and not try to make a deal when the national interest is at stake?
I think there's some of that. Remind yourself, we were down to the absolutely, you know, 11th hour. We were right there at the end. We had to find something. Two guys who had been around for, between the two of them, probably more than 50 years in the Senate. They knew each other well. They had seen all the problems that had been gone ahead before them, between the president and the speaker and anybody else who was great, all the gangs of six and everybody else. They had seen all the problems and understood that there had to be something that both sides could agree upon, that they could then say, we can also, you know, in effect, put off the cliff by in extending it for whatever days they could decide upon. But they had to find something, and they were able to do so because they knew each other and they trusted each other. And quite frankly, we've had a whole lot of lack of members knowing each other, so they can't deal with each other because they don't know each other. And it's one of the great problems in the Congress. And I think you saw two old hands getting together and saying, we're going to put something together that both our sides can accept, even if they don't be happy with it.
Congressman Al, you served in Congress in the days of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. You served in the days when, you know, the Democrats and Republicans had no problem throwing each under the bus on the floor, but going out and having a drink and a cigar afterward. Is this something that Washington politics is longing for, that trusted relationship in that last-minute effort between McConnell and Biden?
Well, if it's not, it should. Bob said it a moment ago. You've got to know each other. Here's the fact. You can't trust somebody if you don't know them. You can't know them if you don't ever get together with them. You know, so you've got a majority, I dare say, of Congress right now that doesn't know each other well enough to cut a deal, to put trust in the word of another member that if you do this, I'll do that. Now, that's clearly what had to happen with the vice president and the Republican leader in the Senate. They both had to say, I'll do this if you'll do that. Then they had to go back and do some checking, one with the president, one with the other, you know, soil sample, his caucus. But they knew that they were talking with somebody that wasn't going to turn around and end up as double-crossing them. That is missing in this Congress, and until it is restored, it is not going to function like any kind of an adult institution that we know about.
Carl Tooven.
One of the things that somehow we have to find a way to do is to go back to the old system that Al's talking about, and that is on committees, getting the committees to know each other, getting them to socialize with one another, whether the president invites the whole Congress down to the White House and they lock the doors and let fellas, women, men, women get to know one another, talk to one another. If they do that, they have trust. As you say, they see each other, they get to know one another, and that's the way to really kind of bring this whole thing together.
Congressman Al.
Let me just send a heart attack through Fred Wertheimer and Ralph Nader and some others. You know where members used to get to know each other as individuals? They took trips. Now, there are two kinds of trips. There's the official trip that is much criticized by the press whenever you do it, the junket, they're called. I have been on a number of those, and they were invaluable. Are they abused? Sometimes, yes, it's a human institution, and you're going to have human beings doing bad things. But they're extremely informational, which is their official purpose, and the ancillary purpose is you get to know your Republican colleague
over a drink after dinner, or sometimes I remember sitting around in bathrobes and slippers having a nightcap.
I don't need that picture of you and Scoob Jackson sitting around in bathrobes and slippers, Al.
I don't think Scoob ever got into a bathrobe. But,
okay.
But I did it with a lot of, and I'm trying to remember the name of, Carlos Moorhead was one, but the Illinois congressman who ended up as Secretary of Agriculture. You were teasing each other, you were interchanging, and you were basically getting to know one another. Now, I particularly got to know Mike Oxley. And lo and behold, he ends up a couple of years later as my ranking Republican on my subcommittee. And we were able to get a rewrite of the Superfund, which was very complex and very controversial, out of the committee 42-zip. We didn't do that by sticking our thumbs in each other's eyes. But had I never taken that trip, what I would have remembered was this was the guy that opposed me trying to get authorization for public broadcasting. I'm a huge fan of public broadcasting. I was really annoyed with this yahoo over on the other side, you know, and I thought terrible things about Oxley. Well, the fact is, anybody who knows Mike Oxley knows that you can't help but like Mike Oxley.
Bob Hines.
I want to pick up on something else, you know, talking about how well the vice president and the minority leader in the Senate know each other. Look at House leadership. Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Boehner don't be. It's a terrible situation. Now, a lot of it's personal. The problem in the Republican side is not that those are the supporters of John Boehner. The problem with John Boehner's problem is he's got this bunch of about 80 or 90 guys, half of the group, and they're wild-eyed crazy radicals.
But it seems
they don't talk to each other. They haven't got the ability to move.
But bottom line, it seems just in the periphery that we looked at the deal coming together and awkward position that Speaker Boehner was, and let's be clear. I mean, Lawrence O'Donnell, who is left of Lenin, came out and said Boehner is not a bad speaker who doesn't know how to do his job. He's just doing what he can do with the bad hand he was dealt.
That is exactly right.
But what
I second that.
But what it seems like is that there's no connectivity. That being Kevin McCarthy from California, Eric Cantor from Virginia as majority leader, and the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. Why is that disconnect there?
Well, let me say this. Recently, on the recent bill, the deficit bill, both McCarthy and Cantor voted against the Speaker.
Right.
Now, but I will say this, and I don't think I'm even slightly off base, because in the last 6 or 8 months, the relationship between those three men has gotten much better. It's one of the reasons is better staff communication and better staff relationships, and another is they're spending more time.
But is it the responsibility of the communication between the members based on the members?
Yeah. And they've got it. Listen, you think they didn't talk to each other? Oh, they did. They just disagreed. Now, I think that it's a very good idea when the majority leader, they're not on the same page. I don't remember a situation in my past on either the Democrat and the Republican when they were in power.
You have to go back to the day. I mean, even Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich got along.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to be the case right now. But the other problem we see here is the politicalization of if this, then that type of politics going on, specifically fiscal cliff versus the Hurricane Sandy aid bill. that ticked off a huge constituency of powerful Northeast Republicans, which, by the way, is a group that you need. Alan Moore, is that a trend we're seeing more prevalent?
No. The Sandy thing was sort of this anomaly. On the heels of this very painful vote of, for the first time, passing a major piece of legislation without a majority of Republicans. The last thing that Boehner wanted to do was follow up with a not uncontroversial $60 billion bill that had never been through a committee, hadn't been subject to any significant review, and ask his guys, oh, by the way, I know you hated the last thing because it's all taxes. How about a $60 billion spending bill on top of that? And he was subject to some open revolt. He knew he was going to take flak, which he did in a big way. And within days, a $10 billion first payment was made, and the rest will be coming in the next couple of weeks. I don't ascribe any great significance to what he did there, and it was totally understandable in my mind.
But I think
his guys got it, including his Northeastern guys, and kind of realized, oh yeah, he does have that problem. We're going to fight for our guys, and I think that one's all smoothed over and on the road.
Carl Tuven.
I think that could have been a real challenge to his speakership if he hadn't been able to go to them and solve the problem as he did by bringing up the 9 million insurance payments when he did. Because, it only took a handful of people to pull away from him to defeat him as speaker. And I think making that compromise, which was good and helped alleviate that situation.
Well, but again, but let's be real, though. I mean, the public outcry just showed almost a segmentation in the Republican Party. Bob Hines, you had Chris Christie, arguably front runner for the nomination in 2016. You had strong, prominent Northeast Republicans, including Peter King, Frank Lobiondo. Those are big names you don't want going against you, especially when you have a fragmented party in the majority in the House.
Those guys did exactly what any one of the four of us at this table would do if we were members from the Northeast part of the country.
True.
They banged on the table and yelled, we want the money for our guys and gals who are sitting out there in a pile of rubble called their house. That's what he was doing. It's a perfectly understandable thing. And you saw what Peter King said. The matter's over. It's just fine. I got no problems at all. And I think they all pretty much feel that way. Those guys did what they had to do as local representatives. And as soon as the speaker gave them a bit of an out by pushing the $10 billion on the insurance stuff through, everybody was happy.
But
comfortable.
Congressman Al.
But I don't understand why Boehner did what I consider the only truly dumb thing he's done since Speaker. How could you not fund that?
Well, there's so much in the bill that isn't part of
Sandy. Let's be clear. I mean, CNN called out appropriations for National Park Service. For those who don't know, Liberty Island is still closed and has been decimated, its infrastructure totally wiped out on the Statue Island itself. There's appropriations to fix that. Amtrak's infrastructure on its most profitable route in the Northeast Corridor took tremendous hits. And you're talking about critical infrastructure such as Con Ed needing to rebuild transformer vaults in Lower Manhattan. We failed to realize that we had Lower Manhattan south of 39th Street in the dark for several days.
And wet.
And that's never happened. Critical infrastructure like the subways, the PATH train, they all need that funding. And the one thing this government does in an emergency is provide fiscal assistance, and we call that into question. Now you have an American public that sits there and says, wait a minute, if you guys won't even provide me disasters, if you're going to fight about getting me back into my house with aid, I don't want you responding. I need that aid, but you guys are still fighting about it. That makes no sense. And it seems like we're making more and more issues, political issues, that's why we have a 9% approval rating in Congress.
Wait. We're talking about $60 billion that never went through a committee, even on a sort of a fast track. I think that had the whole fiscal cliff process gone a little bit differently, we might have passed the whole 60, but I don't think it's totally crazy or unreasonable to say, let's be sure we know everything we're doing here. That was not what was behind Boehner, though. His hesitation was, I have rammed this other thing down their throats at some peril to our leadership, and I have to believe that Boehner and his senior guys said, you could face open rebellion if on the heels of letting the Democrats, in effect, provide the lion's share of the votes for this tax bill, if we come back with a big spending bill that has holes in it and gaps and no offsets in spending anywhere else, which was part of this issue, we could have open revolt. So he was in a horrible place, the old proverbial rock and hard place, because he was going to be damned if he went this way and damned if he went other way. He took this particular path. He took some flack. He came back with a two-step process. I think it's over and done with, but I don't think there should be a great surprise that he had to find a path through this really difficult situation he found himself in.
No, and it's to his credit that he did find a way.
I couldn't agree with more.
What I'm questioning is that he couldn't see that this was just going to raise holy hell with the delegations from the Northeast, and that they were going to say a lot of bad things, and they were then they
well, I think
did
he
what
knew
they did.
They were going to say bad things.
I agree with Bob. He totally knew that.
Yeah, he knew what he was getting into. He just decided that it was the better course of value to do it the way he was trying to do it, and they did exactly what local Congress people ought to do: raise holy hell. Because they wanted to show how strong they were to support their local people,
right,
who are sitting on piles of dirt instead of living in their house.
And I totally agree with that part. I'm questioning whether doing it in a two-part way. You ended up in the same place. But
well, they still haven't voted. They still haven't voted on the second part. All they did was pass the $9.2 billion flood insurance policy, which is basically going to get the insurance policies paid up.
But
what you don't have is the issue of how are they going to fix the critical infrastructure that's already been damaged by Sandy. That bill is still sitting on
the
floor.
They're going to be able to do that next week, probably, isn't it?
The 15th.
All right, fine. Look, that's next week.
But that's 2 weeks, though, of funding. That's a huge deal.
It's a huge deal, but it ain't a big, huge crisis. The point is, there are probably some things in that bill. The committee looks at it over the next 5 or 6 days. We'll say, we don't need that in the bill. That's totally irrelevant to the bill. It's not like fixing the railroads. It's not like fixing anything else that's got to be done. It's probably there's some things they can probably take out, and they can say, well, this is the reason we put it to take out the things that have nothing to do with Sandy, but they just stuck some things in the same way they did it on the fiscal cliff bill.
So then what it sounds like to me is that the problem's not with the bill. The problem is the way that committees and the members are able to put on either plus ups, add ons, or amendments on these emergency funding bills. Do we need to change the rules in the House, Bob?
No, it's not the rules. The Senate.
Not the rules.
It's just the members doing it. They're going to do it.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, it's how the system works. If my memory serves, there's a couple of items in that bill. Remember that bill came over from the Senate?
Correct.
And there's some stuff in that bill for Hawaii.
Correct.
Now, what would that be about? That would be about Dan Inouye. Well, sadly, he's no longer with us. My guess is that there will be changes in whatever was in there for Hawaii, and there will be other changes in a whole host of other provisions in there that folks were able to stick in, you know, their, quote, small little things, a few million here and a few million there, because you happen to be one of the people inside the room. And now for face-saving purposes, if nothing else, I'm sure that that the House leadership will say, here's some things we were able to improve on in this bill.
Well,
and
Alan, I've got to tell you this. This is the first argument I've heard that I agreed with. The Senate screwed it up. They always do. And,
spoken like a House member.
Hold on. Let me put on my shocked face, Al.
I'm satisfied now.
All right.
There we go. We got a couple of minutes left in the segment, but now I'm going to take an opportunity. I need to make a correction. During the fiscal cliff soiree on January 2nd, MSNBC reported that Speaker Boehner was going to resign he was going to withdraw his name from consideration for speakership. That was reported by Martin Brashear's program on January 2nd. I, as moderator, retweeted that statement heard on MSNBC by millions of people, and I bought into that unconfirmed report. It was a mistake on my part. I am a huge supporter of Speaker Boehner. I was shocked to hear it. But in the interest of being breaking news journalists, we took something that we heard from another reliable news source that was not confirmed, and we rebroadcast that, and that was wrong. So I want to offer my apology, my personal apology, to Speaker Boehner, and I wish him many, many happy years as Speaker. I'm glad he's still there, but I need to get that correction out of the way. That report was incorrect.
Here,
so.
Here.
We stand by, you know, we are reliable journalists. Well, Alan has facts, but we try to be reliable journalists on this show.
That's very generous of you, and you're absolutely right.
We got that out of the way. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit, what's going to be the big political news items in 2013 that we need to look at? We're going to look into our crystal ball, which is never right to begin with, but it's always good radio. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear... Everybody knows Shelley's Back Room for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf, ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of, ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner, in a corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. I'm misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And we're back here live from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We are coming into the final segment of our program where we want to talk a little bit about the big news stories that could be in 2013. I'm going to put on our crystal balls, our little wizard's hat and find out exactly what we think is going to be the big news items to look forward to. Congressman Al, I'm going to start with you. What do you foresee coming down the pike politically in 2013 that we should keep an eye on?
Well, my crystal balls.
Talking to the microphone, you've turned the wrong way, Al.
Oh,
good Lord. Well, he's moving. Bob Hines, I'll go to you.
All right. I will tell you what I think is going to be the biggest stories, and that is the effort of both parties to try to find a way to solve the debt problems and the entitlement problems, and putting some revenues on the table, probably from fixing the tax laws. Those three battles are going to take far beyond the next 2 months. We are going to be talking about probably the deficit starting in a week or two. We will probably run right out all the way up to the end of February, which is almost our deadline, I think, according to Secretary Geithner. So we'll probably be dealing with that from the middle of January right to the middle of February. And then we've got only 2 weeks to take care of the fiscal cliff, which we will then kick down the road again probably until the end of June, so we have another 3 or 4 months to solve that problem.
Well, let's talk about something you brought up. There's some key administration changes that are going on right now, as is the case in any midterm or going into the second term of any presidency. There are going to be some changes. But in this case, President Obama is losing his top three cabinet members, his Secretary of Defense, his Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Treasury.
And he's made three very good appointments.
Well, he's got replacing Geithner. Has he announced who he's going to have replace Secretary Geithner yet?
No.
But you have the former senator from Kansas, Chuck Hagel, Republican.
Nebraska, rather.
Chuck Hagel. Who has been officially nominated by the president for Secretary of Defense, but he's getting a lot of backlash. Congressman Al, why is he getting the backlash, do you think, that he is, the Democrats?
Well, because he's a Republican.
Okay.
Come on.
And he's getting backlash from the Republicans because there are people who just think a rational man is a bad man.
I think that the right wing of the Republican Party is what's going to give him his problems from that direction. Narrow-mindedness on the part of the narrow-minded partisanship on the part of the Democrats, I think, explains some of their opposition. And then when you start fooling around with Israel, you talk about a third rail. For Democrats, that's bad news.
And then you see some Democrats, particularly on the extreme left, saying, why aren't there some women? So I think I wouldn't be surprised if the president isn't trying to find a Secretary of Treasury who would be a woman who would be well qualified. I'm sure there are some.
Well, let's look. I mean, there were a couple of issues. One, the Democrats don't like him, like you said, because he's a Republican. The Republicans don't like him because he's a very practical, moderate Republican when he served as senator from Nebraska. But when you look at, he had other baggage. He had some pretty inflammatory comments regarding gays back in his term as senator. But even the gay community has forgiven him and said he would be a logical choice.
Well,
Congressman Al.
And that whole gay issue has moved a lot since he made the remarks that he made. What he believes about that today, I don't know. But he was not out of step with a lot of general thinking at the time that he made those remarks. many people were making remarks then that they would not repeat now on that issue.
That's a reality on so many social issues as we move forward and we change our views.
Well, I want to get Alan Moore's take. Alan Moore, it seems that Chuck Hagel's taking a huge hit from his own party and from the Democrats. Why is Chuck Hagel so radioactive for Secretary of Defense, in your opinion?
Well, I didn't hear the earlier conversation because we got disconnected, but I hear your question now, and I think I can respond to the question. And I'm sorry if I repeat anything anyone else said, but Hagel is a very outspoken guy, and he's a smart guy, and like a lot of people in Washington, probably thinks he's smarter than he is on most things, and he has gotten carried away sometimes with a little bit of a know-it-all attitude, which it's kicked off some of his colleagues, Democrats and Republicans. He doesn't always play well with others. And when you burn some bridges among friends, people have long memories for that kind of stuff. And I think part of his problem is just that he's angered people over time by being something of a know-it-all. Smart as he is and interesting as he is, he's ticked people off. I don't think anything he has said in the past is in any way disqualifying. I just question why the president wants a guy with such a reputation for simply thumbing his nose at his teammates and kind of flaunting it. It's fine to disagree, perfectly appropriate. The president certainly needs to hear a range of voices. But Hagel has had a pattern of doing it in quite public, in sort of aggressive ways, and it's like, you don't like that, let's take it outside, kind of an attitude, which is amusing for the outside. The press loves that stuff, but it's something he's going to have to overcome. I'm guessing he will. I'm guessing he'll be confirmed, which raises the whole question of, you know, has he got the right temperament, background, and experience? He's never run anything really big. There ain't anything much bigger than the Defense Department. I think he's about to get a huge lesson in what it means to be the manager of a monstrous, of a gigantic enterprise. And he's going to be overcome with meetings and questions and challenges and find out what 24/7 work really is all about.
Right.
I don't see him lasting more than a couple of years.
Wow.
But I do see him getting confirmed.
Wow. Okay. We're also looking at, and largely everybody's come out and said that they'll approve his nomination, and that is Secretary Kerry replacing Senator Kerry out of Massachusetts replacing Secretary Clinton as Secretary of State. Carl Tooven, is that a smart move? Is Kerry the right guy?
You know, I think so. John Kerry has done a lot of traveling, officially and unofficially, throughout the world. He knows a lot of world leaders. He's been at foreign policy during his whole career in the Senate, in the Foreign Relations Committee, and being the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He's fairly well respected and fairly well grounded in foreign policy issues. He's going to have some real headaches in the second term with the Middle East, with Iran, with Israel, and all these things are going to come to a head in the next 1, 2, or 3 years. So it's going to be a lot on his plate, but I think that, you know, the president sets the policy, and I think Kerry will be a good voice in talking to the president, as will the vice president, as will other cabinet members. But Kerry will be an educated voice in this area.
And I agree with Carl on that, but one should say that Mrs. Clinton is going to be a hard act to follow.
Yeah. Well, that's the big question is, I mean, members of both parties have admitted that Secretary Clinton was, without a doubt, a phenomenal Secretary of State. Kerry, not exactly as dynamic as Hillary Clinton, not as, I don't want to say politically astute, astute as Hillary Clinton when it comes to dealing with international issues, but he seems to be a very grounded voice to the president when it comes to foreign affairs. Is that accurate, Bob?
I think so. I think Carl hits it very well. He has spent a great deal of his time as chairman of the
Foreign Services or Foreign Relations
overseas, talking to a wide, very wide variety of people. He's got some very good relationships. He's trusted. He's respected. He has been a solid, sensible voice. He's stayed close to the administration policy at the same time that he has picked up a great deal of information. He knows what he's talking about. I think he's going to be a very successful Secretary of State.
The big question, though, is who does he have replace Timothy Geithner? Those two are big shoes to fill. Carl Toobin, any idea who he might put up on the block?
Not at this point.
Alan Moore, any ideas on your end who the president might put into place to Secretary of Treasury?
Well, the name that has been at the forefront for a long time is Jack Lew, who's currently his chief of staff, former head of OMB, former deputy secretary of state, very senior, accomplished guy. The president relies on him heavily as chief of staff, but Treasury is a really important job, and he certainly earned the job should he want it. Erskine Bowles' name continues to come up, even though Bowles has indicated that he's not interested. But I think he would be another really interesting choice.
Is there any chance that the president might go outside of Washington and look towards Wall Street or the business community?
Always that chance. Yep, it's there's some senior Democrat players from prior administrations who are back up on Wall Street. Wall Street leaders and Democrats, the Democratic Party, it's not the greatest mix right now, just in terms of optics and how the party faithful feel. So you'd have to be really, really careful about just who that would be. There aren't too many guys in Wall Street who don't have their hands dirty one way or the other on the disasters of the last 5 years. But they're also the guys who are most educated. Doesn't mean they're always the smartest, because we know that for a fact, having lived through this. But knowledge is important too.
Are there any surprises at who's not leaving? I mean, there was large talk that Secretary Napolitano might leave Department of Homeland Security. There was talk at one point even, but that was quickly quashed. Ray LaHood might leave Transportation. They don't seem to be going anywhere. Are there any surprises at who's staying, Congressman Al?
Well, I am delighted that Ray LaHood is staying.
It appears that he's staying right now.
And I hope he stays. He has been a very solid Secretary of Transportation, and that department hasn't had the best leadership in the world in a long time.
He has probably been the best transportation secretary in that I can recall.
Oh, Normanetta was pretty solid. Yeah. Normanetta was very solid.
And you know, the same reason, because both of them served in the Congress and they understood some of the problems that needed to be solved. And they have both done a damn fine job, Norm earlier and Ray now. They are the kind of people who've done a really good job of what needs to be done.
Carl Toobin, any surprises of who's sticking around?
No.
Alan Moore.
I don't know who's sticking around. You know, I think ask me in a few months. Because, you know, there's probably next week or the week after, nobody was really expecting Lisa Jackson to all of a sudden say, I'm gone. At EPA, and so I wouldn't be surprised if we have another surprise or two down the road.
Okay. Going back in the last few minutes of this segment, I want to go back to Carl Toobin. What's the big thing we're going to be looking for politically 2030?
One of the big things is going to be immigration. It's something that we've been talking about for years, and I think it's something that the administration has to take the lead on. and the two parties have to get together and decide what they're going to do about immigration and come up with some solutions so that we can move on out of this.
And after the way the Hispanics voted in the last election, the Republicans may be a little more tender about their the way they handle this. I don't think they're going to reverse themselves, but the rhetoric may well calm down,
right.
And that may make it easier to do something in that area.
Alan Moore, what do you think the big thing we need to look at in 2013 is going to be?
Oh, I still think it's all about the economic challenges, you know, the next cliff, debt limit, and I say the next cliff in a couple of months will make some kind of a decision relating to spending, but then the details will follow over the course of this year, and I do believe that the Ways and Means Committee in the House and Finance Committee in the Senate are going to be spending a lot of time this year trying to figure out proposed changes in Medicare, Social Security, and tax reform. And both committees have jurisdiction over all those areas. That's where there's going to be a lot of action this year. It's the details of the hard decisions to come, and they'll be made first off in those committees before they get to the
Congressman Al.
I think the one thing that you can predict with no fear of being found wrong is that the biggest issue next year will be one we haven't considered yet.
Good point. And we still haven't even touched on the debt ceiling that comes up in another 60 days as well. We've got that issue. Bob Hines, are we going to have another three-ring circus like we had with the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling crisis?
Yes.
It's going to be as toxic as it was.
Yes.
Very good. Very well put. But when we look at 2013, we almost sound like a broken record when we talk about this, but can we get back to a point of civility in Congress and in Washington, D.C. politics this year? I mean,
not in the near term.
Carl Tubman, you agree?
The one good thing that I saw in some of the news things that I watched was one congressman who went out in 1980. He came back because he couldn't find anybody. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he was talking about what we have talked about, the old style, getting people together, getting them to know each other, getting them to trust one another. And there was a young Republican, might have been from Kansas, or Oklahoma, who said, you know, I got tired of only talking to Republicans. So I got on the Democratic bus and started talking to Democrats. And guess what? I found some of them were likable, and I think I could do the business with some.
You know, we saw that in a couple. I mean, you mentioned Oklahoma. I mean, the notable Democrat that was constantly dealing with Republicans was Dan Boren, recently retired Democratic congressman out of Oklahoma, too. Dan Boren, huge loss, was a good guy to make a deal with. Bob Hunt?
Well, let's put it this way. I think long term that there will be a gradual recognition that we've got to work together. It isn't working now, and I think neither side likes what they don't like it because neither side can, quote, win. It doesn't work that way. And I think it's going to take a while, though, it's going to take a while to translate the idea of, well, we can't win, what do we do, in order to find a way that members are spending more time talking across aisles, trying to find ways to work together. I think it's going to take a significant amount of time. I don't see it happening in 2013. I think we'll probably see some efforts at it, but it's going to be a very difficult time. It takes a long time to change a structure that has become as non-functional as the House of Representatives.
Right.
Well, the Senate is much better off because there's fewer, number one, and they've got no choice but to work with each other, and because those committees are smaller, the groups are smaller when they work. It makes it easier for them to work together.
Well, we got 10 minutes left in the show, our first show of 2013, and it's the first of my favorite segments for 2013. It's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about buzz, innuendo, rumor that we're hearing around. Sometimes we're right, and sometimes we're wrong, but it's always good radio. Congressman Al, tell me a story.
The Tea Party is on its way out. It will take a while. It's not going to happen overnight. But they are hurting the Republican Party enormously. And ultimately, the Republican Party is going to have to figure out some way to deal with them. And I think the best way is to let the voters ultimately deal with that by the Republicans taking more middle-of-the-road positions and less extreme right positions.
Wow. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
I'm just going to repeat something that we've all been talking about. The next few months, with the debt ceiling, with the fiscal cliff, is going to be really, really hard work for the members of the Congress. We can only wish them well. We can only hope that they will do a better job than they've done in the past. But it's going to be something that we are going to be talking here day in and day out, every damn week, because it's going to be the biggest, toughest fight that in the shortest period of time that we have probably ever seen the Congress try to get some things done, except maybe in World War II. This is really a big problem, and we really got to find some leadership and some willingness to work together. It's going to be hard. Let's hope that they can do it.
Carl Tooven, tell me a story.
Just to add to that, and then a little story. To add to that is that if the Republicans keep fighting within themselves and keep holding back the Congress from the House from acting as it should, there could be a real turmoil in the Republican Party in 2014. Even with the redistricting.
Yeah.
Number two, Alan Simpson and Mr. Bowles were on Meet the Press last weekend, and they were talking about, you know, Simpson Bowles, and somehow the subject came up on why wasn't it Bowles Simpson? And Alan Simpson said, because we didn't want it to be BS, because that's what everybody would say, that all this is BS, when it really wasn't BS. It was something that should have been acted on, and hopefully maybe still it's not too late for something to be acted on.
Leave it to the witty and wise former gentleman from Wyoming.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
An incredible person.
Yeah. He's one hell of a smart guy, and so is Mr. Bowles.
Yeah. He is. My story this week is...
Don't forget me.
Alan Moore, tell me a story.
When John Kerry becomes Secretary of State, which I have every reason to believe he will, there will be a vacancy in the Senate. That vacancy will be filled for about 5 to 6 months by an appointee of Governor Deval Patrick, at which point there will be an election. This is a special situation in Massachusetts that happened not that many years ago, where they have an election then to fill out the rest of Kerry's term. So the question is, who will be the temporary senator? Barney Frank has made a rather unseemly bunch of comments where he's just basically begging to be the senator for 5 months. My guess is that Patrick won't go in that direction and doesn't dislike the Senate that much, and will either appoint a person that he then thinks will run and that to give him a leg up. But my choice, keep your eye on, a man who filled this very same role very ably just a few years ago, and that's Paul Kirk, longtime National Democratic Committee chairman, well-respected. He has been a U.S. senator for all of about 5 months after Ted Kennedy died and before Scott Brown was elected. So I think they might bring Kirk back for another round of the same thing. So they'll have an experienced senator who will not be running again.
Well, does that give him enough time to get Senate retirement pay?
Not even close. That's all mythology.
Paul doesn't need the money.
That's true too. Story is gun control going to be very much a very interesting dynamic on the Hill this year. You've got a very strongly voiced NRA that's trying to reinvent himself after the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. You're going to see a lot more of an undertone, a lot more under-the-radar lobbying instead of the in-your-face lobbying by a lot of the gun rights activists, and a lot of the members are going to be taking a quiet stance on some of these gun control issues. Would not be surprised if we see some key Republicans supporting some various gun control legislation that might be like here in the next few months. Keep your eye on that. We'll be talking about it. But on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Carl Tooven, Alan Moore out there. Alan, I hope you feel better, buddy.
Well, I'm after the last 2 hours, I'm invigorated.
Well, we hope to see you here next week. This has been Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
The more you pay attention to this wonderful program, the more you realize this is the place to be.
That's absolutely true. We'll see you next week. Have a great week, Radio Land. Bye-bye.